Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Chapter 13 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Joan Freeman. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 13. A Sweeter Woman Ne'er Drew Breath. Thenceforward, Eric Marshall was a constant visitor at the Gordon homestead. He soon became a favorite with Thomas and Janet, especially the latter. He liked them both, discovering under all their outward peculiarities sterling worth and fitness of character. Thomas Gordon was surprisingly well-read and could floor Eric any time in argument, once he became sufficiently warmed up to attain fluency of words. Eric hardly recognized him the first time he saw him thus animated. His bent form straightened, his sunken eyes flashed, his face flushed, his voice rang like a trumpet, and he poured out a flood of eloquence which swept Eric's smart, up-to-date arguments away like straws in the rush of a mountain torrent. Eric enjoyed his own defeat enormously, but Thomas Gordon was ashamed of being thus drawn out of himself, and for a week afterwards confined his remarks to yes and no, or, at the outside, to a brief statement that a change in the weather was brewing. Janet never talked on matters of church and state. Such she plainly considered to be far beyond a woman's province. But she listened with lurking interest in her eyes while Thomas and Eric pelted on each other with facts and statistics and opinions, and on the rare occasions when Eric scored a point, she permitted herself a sly little smile at her brother's expense. Of Neil, Eric saw but little. The Italian boy avoided him, or if they chanced to meet, passed him by with sullen, downcast eyes. Eric did not trouble himself greatly about Neil, but Thomas Gordon, understanding the motive which had led Neil to betray his discovery of the orchard trysts, bluntly told Kilmeny that she must not make such an equal of Neil as she had done. "You have been too kind to the lad, lassie, and he's got presumptuous. He must be taught his place. I mistrust we have all made more of him than we should." But most of the idyllic hours of Eric's wooing were spent in the old orchard. The garden end of it was now a wilderness of roses. Roses red as the heart of a sunset, roses pink as the early flush of dawn, roses white as the snows on mountain peaks, roses full-blown, and roses in buds that were sweeter than anything on earth except Kilmeny's face. Their petals fell in silken heaps along the old paths, or clung to the lush grasses among which Eric lay and dreamed, while Kilmeny played to him on her violin. Eric promised himself that when she was his wife, her wonderful gift for music should be cultivated to the utmost. Her powers of expression seemed to deepen and develop every day, growing as her soul grew, taking on new color and richness from her ripening heart. To Eric, the days were all pages in an inspired idyll. He had never dreamed that love could be so mighty, or the world so beautiful. He wondered if the universe were big enough to hold his joy, or eternity long enough to live it out. His whole existence was, for the time being, bounded by that orchard where he wooed his sweetheart. All other ambitions and plans and hopes were set aside in the pursuit of this one aim, the attainment of which would enhance all others a thousandfold. the loss of which would rob all others of their reason for existence. His own world seemed very far away, and the things of that world forgotten. His father, on hearing that he had taken the Lindsay School for a year, had written him a testy, amazed letter, asking him if he were demented. "Or is there a girl in the case?" he wrote. "There must be, to tie you down to a place like Lindsay for a year. Take care, Master Eric. You've been too sensible all your life. A man is bound to make a fool of himself at least once, and when you didn't get through with that in your teens, it may be attacking you now." David also wrote, expostulating more gravely, but he did not express the suspicions Eric knew he must entertain. "Good old David, he is quaking with fear that I am up to something he can't approve of, but he won't say a word by way of attempting to force my confidence." It could not long remain a secret in Lindsay that the master was going to the Gordon place on courting thoughts intent. Mrs. Williamson kept her own and Eric's counsel. The Gordons said nothing, but the secret leaked out, and great was the surprise and gossip and wonder. One or two incautious people ventured to express their opinion of the master's wisdom to the master himself, but they never repeated the experiment. Curiosity was rife. 100 stories were circulated about Kilmeny, all greatly exaggerated in the circulation. Wise heads were shaken, and the majority opined that it was a great pity. The master was a likely young fellow. He could have his pick of almost anybody, you might think. It was too bad that he should go and take up with that queer, dumb niece of the Gordons, who had been brought up in such a heathenish way. But then, you never could guess what way a man's fancy would jump when he set out to pick him a wife. They guessed Neil Gordon didn't like it much. He seemed to have got dreadful moody and sulky of late, and wouldn't sing in the choir any more. Thus the buzz of comment and gossip ran. To those two in the old orchard it mattered not a whit. Kilmeny knew nothing of gossip. To her, Lindsay was as much of an unknown world as the city of Eric's home. Her thoughts strayed far and wide in the realm of her fancy, but they never wandered out to the little realities that hedged her strange life around. In that life she had blossomed out, a fair, unique thing. There were times when Eric almost regretted that one day he must take her out of her white solitude to a world that, in the last analysis, was only Lindsay on a larger scale, with just the same pettiness of thought and feeling and opinion at the bottom of it. He wished he might keep her to himself forever in that old spruce-hidden orchard where the roses fell. One day he indulged himself in the fulfillment of the whim he had formed when Kilmeny had told him she thought herself ugly. He went to Janet and asked her permission to bring a mirror to the house, that he might have the privilege of being the first to reveal Kilmeny to herself, exteriorly. Janet was somewhat dubious at first. "There hasn't been such a thing in the house for 16 years, master. There never was but 3, one in the spare room, and a little one in the kitchen, and Margaret's own. She broke them all the day it first struck her that Kilmeny was going to be Bonnie. I might have got one after she died, maybe, but I didn't think of it, and there's no need of lasses to be always prinking at their looking-glasses." But Eric pleaded and argued skillfully, and finally Janet said, "Well, well, have your own way. You'd have it anyway, I think, lad. You are one of those men who always get their own way. But that is different from the men who take their own way. And that's a mercy," she added under her breath. Eric went to town the next Saturday and picked out a mirror that pleased him. He had it shipped to Radnor, and Thomas Gordon brought it home, not knowing what it was, for Janet had thought it just as well he should not know. "It's a present the master is making Kilmeny," she told him. She sent Kilmeny off to the orchard after tea, and Eric slipped around to the house by way of the main road and lane. He and Janet together unpacked the mirror and hung it on the parlor wall. "I never saw such a big one, master," said Janet, rather doubtfully, as if, after all, she distrusted its gleaming, pearly depth and richly ornamented frame. "I hope it won't make her vain. She is very bonny, but it may not do her any good to know it." "It won't harm her," said Eric confidently. "When a belief in her ugliness hasn't spoiled a girl, a belief in her beauty won't." But Janet did not trust epigrams. She carefully removed a little dust from the polished surface and frowned meditatively at the by no means beautiful reflection she saw therein. "I cannot think what made Kilmeny suppose she was ugly, master." "Her mother told her she was," said Eric, rather bitterly. "Ah," Janet shot a quick glance at the picture of her sister. "Was that it? Margaret was a strange woman, master. I suppose she thought her own beauty had been a snare to her. She was bonny. That picture doesn't do her justice. I never liked it. It was taken before she met Ronald Fraser. We none of us thought it very like her at the time, but, master, 3 years later it was like her. Oh, it was like her then. That very look came in her face." "Kilmeny doesn't resemble her mother," remarked Eric, glancing at the picture with the same feeling of mingled fascination and distaste with which he always regarded it. "Does she look like her father?" "No, not a great deal, though some of her ways are very like his. She looks like a grandmother. Margaret's mother, master. Her name was Kilmeny, too, and she was a handsome, sweet woman. I was very fond of my stepmother, master. When she died, she gave her baby to me, and asked me to be a mother to it. Ah, well, I tried. But I couldn't fence the sorrow out of Margaret's life, and it sometimes comes to my mind that maybe I'll not be able to fence it out of Kilmeny's either." "That will be my task," said Eric. "You'll do your best, I do not doubt. But maybe it will be through you that sorrow will come to her after all." "Not through any fault of mine, Aunt Janet." "Oh, no, no, I'm not saying it will be your fault, but my heart misgives me at times. Oh, I dare say I am only a foolish old woman, master. Go your ways and bring your lass here to look at your plaything when you like. I'll not make or meddle with it." Janet betook herself to the kitchen, and Eric went to look for Kilmeny. She was not in the orchard, and it was not until he had searched for some time that he found her. She was standing under a beech tree in a field beyond the orchard, leaning on the longer fence, with her hands clasped against her cheek. In them she held a white Mary Lily from the orchard. She did not run to meet him while he was crossing the pasture, as she would once have done. She waited motionless until he was close to her. Eric began, half laughingly, half tenderly, to quote some lines from her namesake ballad. "Kilmeny, Kilmeny, where have you been? Long have we sought Beth Holt and Den, by Lynn, by Ford, and Greenwood Tree, yet ye are halesome and fair to see. Where got you that jupe of the lily sheen, that bonny snood o' the birk sea green, and those roses, the fairest that ever was seen? Kilmeny, Kilmeny, where have you been? Only it's a lily and not a rose you are carrying. I might go on and quote the next couplet, too. Kilmeny looked up with a lovely grace, but there was nae smile on Kilmeny's face. Why are you looking so sober?" Kilmeny did not have her slate with her and could not answer. But Eric guessed from something in her eyes that she was bitterly contrasting the beauty of the ballad's heroine with her own supposed ugliness. "Come down to the house, Kilmeny. I have something there to show you, something lovelier than you have ever seen before," he said, with boyish pleasure shining in his eyes. "I want you to go and put on that muslin dress you wore last Sunday evening, and pin up your hair the same way you did then. Run along, don't wait for me, but you are not to go into the parlor until I come. I want to pick some of those Mary Lilies up in the orchard." When Eric returned to the house with an armful of the long-stemmed white Madonna lilies that blossomed in the orchard, Kilmeny was just coming down the steep, narrow staircase with its striped carpeting of homespun drugget. Her marvelous loveliness was brought out into brilliant relief by the dark woodwork and shadows of the dim old hall. She wore a trailing, clinging dress of some creamy-tinted fabric that had been her mother's. It had not been altered in any respect, for fashion held no sway at the Gordon homestead, and Kilmeny thought that the dress left nothing to be desired. Its quaint style suited her admirably. The neck was slightly cut away to show the round white throat, and the sleeves were long, full bishops, out of which her beautiful slender hands slipped like flowers from their sheaths. She had crossed her long braids at the back and pinned them about her head like a coronet. A late white rose was fastened low down on the left side. A man had given all other bliss and all his worldly wealth for this, to waste his whole heart in one kiss upon her perfect lips, quoted Eric in a whisper as he watched her descend. Aloud, he said, "Take these lilies on your arm, letting their bloom fall against your shoulder. So, now, give me your hand and shut your eyes. Don't open them until I say you may." He led her into the parlor and up to the mirror. "Look!" he cried gaily. Kilmeny opened her eyes and looked straight into the mirror where, like a lovely picture in a golden frame, she saw herself reflected. For a moment she was bewildered. Then she realized what it meant. The lilies fell from her arm to the floor and she turned pale. With a little, low, involuntary cry, she put her hands over her face. Eric pulled them boyishly away. "Kilmeny, do you think you are ugly now? This is a truer mirror than Aunt Janet's silver sugar bowl. Look, look, look! Did you ever imagine anything fairer than yourself, dainty Kilmeny?" She was blushing now, and stealing shy, radiant glances at the mirror. With a smile, she took her slate and wrote naively, "I think I am pleasant to look upon. I cannot tell you how glad I am. It is so dreadful to believe one is ugly. You can get used to everything else, but you never get used to that. It hurts just the same every time you remember it. But why did Mother tell me I was ugly? Could she really have thought so? Perhaps I have become better looking since I grew up." "I think perhaps your mother had found that beauty is not always a blessing, Kilmeny, and thought it wiser not to let you know you possessed it. Come, let us go back into the orchard now. We mustn't waste this rare evening in the house. There is going to be a sunset that we shall remember all our lives. The mirror will hang here. It is yours. Don't look into it too often, though, or Aunt Janet will disapprove. She is afraid it will make you vain." Kilmeny gave one of her rare musical laughs, which Eric never heard without a recurrence of the old wonder that she could laugh so when she could not speak. She blew an airy little kiss at her mirrored face and turned from it, smiling happily. On their way to the orchard they met Neil. He went by them with an averted face, but Kilmeny shivered and involuntarily drew nearer to Eric. "I don't understand Neil at all now," she wrote nervously. "He is not nice as he used to be, and sometimes he will not answer me when I speak to him. And he looks so strangely at me, too. Besides, he is surly and impertinent to Uncle and Aunt." "Don't mind Neil," said Eric lightly. "He is probably sulky because of some things I said to him when I found he had spied on us." That night, before she went upstairs, Kilmeny stole into the parlor for another glimpse of herself in that wonderful mirror by the light of a dim little candle she carried. She was still lingering there dreamily when Aunt Janet's grim face appeared in the shadows of the doorway. "Are you thinking about your own good looks, lassie?" "Aye, but remember that handsome is as handsome does," she said, with grudging admiration. For the girl with her flushed cheeks and shining eyes was something that even dour Janet Gordon could not look upon unmoved. Kilmeny smiled softly. "I'll try to remember," she wrote. "But oh, Aunt Janet, I am so glad I am not ugly. It is not wrong to be glad of that, is it?" The older woman's face softened. "No, I don't suppose it is, lassie," she conceded. "A comely face is something to be thankful for, as none know better than those who have never possessed it. I remember well when I was a girl. But that is neither here nor there. The master thinks you are wonderful bonny, Kilmeny," she added, looking keenly at the girl. Kilmeny started, and a scarlet blush scorched her face. That and the expression that flashed into her eyes told Janet Gordon all she wished to know. With a stifled sigh, she bade her niece good night and went away. Kilmeny ran fleetly up the stairs to her dim little room that looked out into the spruces, and flung herself on her bed, burying her burning face in the pillow. Her aunt's words had revealed to her the hidden secret of her heart. She knew that she loved Eric Marshall. and the knowledge brought with it a strange anguish. For was she not dumb? All night she lay staring wide-eyed through the darkness till the dawn. End of chapter 13.
Chapter 14 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Katie Gibney, Arkansas, March 2008. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 14. In Her Selfless Mood. Eric noticed a change in Kilmeny at their next meeting, a change that troubled him. She seemed aloof, abstracted, almost ill at ease. When he proposed an excursion to the orchard, he thought she was reluctant to go. The days that followed convinced him of the change. Something had come between them. Kilmeny seemed as far away from him as if she had in truth, like her namesake of the ballad, sojourned for 7 years in the land where the rain never fell and the wind never blew, and had come back washed clean from all the affections of earth. Eric had a bad week of it, but he determined to put an end to it by plain speaking. One evening, in the orchard, he told her of his love. It was an evening in August, with wheat fields ripening to their harvestry, a soft violet night made for love, with the distant murmur of an unquiet sea on a rocky shore sounding through it. Kilmeny was sitting on the old bench where he had first seen her. She had been playing for him, but her music did not please her, and she laid aside the violin with a little frown. It might be that she was afraid to play, afraid that her new emotions might escape her and reveal themselves in music. It was difficult to prevent this, so long had she been accustomed to pour out all her feelings in harmony. The necessity for restraint irked her, and made of her bow a clumsy thing which no longer obeyed her wishes. More than ever at that instant did she long for speech, speech that would conceal and protect where dangerous silence might betray. In a low voice that trembled with earnestness, Eric told her that he loved her, that he had loved her from the first time he had seen her in that old orchard. He spoke humbly, but not fearfully, for he believed that she loved him, and he had little expectation of any rebuff. "Kilmeny, will you be my wife?" he asked finally, taking her hands in his. Kilmeny had listened with averted face. At first she had blushed painfully, but now she had grown very pale. When he had finished speaking and was waiting for her answer, she suddenly pulled her hands away, and, putting them over her face, burst into tears and noiseless sobs. "Kilmeny, dearest, have I alarmed you? Surely you knew before that I loved you. Don't you care for me?" Eric said, putting his arm about her and trying to draw her to him. But she shook her head sorrowfully, and wrote with compressed lips, "Yes, I do love you, but I will never marry you, because I cannot speak." "Oh, Kilmeny," said Eric, smiling, for he believed his victory won. "That doesn't make any difference to me. You know it doesn't, sweetest. If you love me, that is enough." But Kilmeny only shook her head again. There was a very determined look on her pale face. She wrote, "No, it is not enough. It would be doing you a great wrong to marry you when I cannot speak, and I will not do it because I love you too much to do anything that would harm you. Your world would think you had done a very foolish thing, and it would be right. I have thought it all over many times since something Aunt Janet said made me understand, and I know I am doing right. I am sorry I did not understand sooner, before you had learned to care so much." "Kilmeny, darling, you have taken a very absurd fancy into that dear black head of yours. Don't you know that you will make me miserably unhappy all my life if you will not be my wife?" "No, you think so now, and I know you will feel very badly for a time. Then you will go away, and after a while you will forget me, and then you will see that I was right. I shall be very unhappy too, but that is better than spoiling your life. Do not plead or coax, because I shall not change my mind." Eric did plead and coax, however, at first patiently and smilingly, as one might argue with a dear foolish child, then with vehement and distracted earnestness, as he began to realize that Kilmeny meant what she said. It was all in vain. Kilmeny grew paler and paler, and her eyes revealed how keenly she was suffering. She did not even try to argue with him, but only listened patiently and sadly, and shook her head. Say what he would, entreat and implore as he might, he could not move her resolution a hair's breadth. Yet he did not despair. He could not believe that she would adhere to such a resolution. He felt sure that her love for him would eventually conquer, and he went home not unhappily after all. He did not understand that it was the very intensity of her love which gave her the strength to resist his pleading, where a more shallow affection might have yielded. It held her back unflinchingly from doing him what she believed to be a wrong. End of chapter 14.
Chapter 15 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Karen Savage. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 15. An Old, Unhappy, Far-Off Thing. The next day Eric sought Kilmeny again, and renewed his pleadings, but again in vain. Nothing he could say, no argument which he could advance, was of any avail against her sad determination. When he was finally compelled to realize that her resolution was not to be shaken, he went in his despair to Janet Gordon. Janet listened to his story with concern and disappointment plainly visible on her face. When he had finished, she shook her head. "I'm sorry, master. I can't tell you how sorry I am. I had hoped for something very different. Hoped! I have prayed for it! Thomas and I are getting old, and it has weighed on my mind for years what was to become of Kilmeny when we would be gone. Since you came I had hoped that she would have a protector in you, but if Kilmeny says she will not marry you, I am afraid she'll stick to it." "But she loves me," cried the young man, "and if you and her uncle speak to her, urge her, perhaps you can influence her." "No, master, it wouldn't be any use." "Oh, we will, of course, but it will not be any use. Kilmeny is as determined as her mother when once she makes up her mind. She has always been good and obedient for the most part, but once or twice we have found out that there is no moving her if she does resolve upon anything. When her mother died, Thomas and I wanted to take her to church. We could not prevail on her to go. We did not know why then, but now I suppose it was because she believed she was so very ugly. It is because she thinks so much of you that she will not marry you. She is afraid you would come to repent having married a dumb girl. Maybe she is right. Maybe she is right." "I cannot give her up," said Eric stubbornly. "Something must be done. Perhaps her defect can be remedied even yet. Have you ever had her examined by a doctor qualified to pronounce on her case? Have you?" "No, master. We never took her to anyone. When we first began to fear that she was never going to talk, Thomas wanted to take her to Charlottetown and have her looked to. He thought so much of the child and he felt terrible about it, but her mother wouldn't hear of it being done. There was no use trying to argue with her. She said that it would be no use, that it was her sin that was visited on the child, and it could never be taken away." "And did you give in meekly to a morbid whim like that?" asked Eric impatiently. "Master, you didn't know my sister. We had to give in. Nobody could hold out against her. She was a strange woman, and a terrible woman in many ways, after her trouble. We were afraid to cross her for fear she would go out of her mind."
"But could you not have taken Kilmeny to a doctor unknown to her mother?"
"No, that was not possible. Margaret never let her out of her sight, not even when she was grown up. Besides, to tell you the whole truth, master, we didn't think ourselves that it would be much use to try to cure Kilmeny. It was a sin that made her as she is."
"Aunt Janet, how can you talk such nonsense? Where was there any sin? Your sister thought herself a lawful wife. If Ronald Fraser thought otherwise, and there is no proof that he did, he committed a sin. But you surely do not believe that it was visited in this fashion on his innocent child?"
"No, I am not meaning that, master. That wasn't where Margaret did wrong, and though I never did like Ronald Fraser overmuch, I must say this in his defense. I believe he thought himself a free man when he married Margaret. No, it's something else, something far worse. It gives me a shiver whenever I think of it. Oh, master, the good book is right when it says the sins of the parents are visited on the children. There isn't a truer word in it than that from cover to cover."
"What in heaven's name is the meaning of all this?" exclaimed Eric. "Tell me what it is. I must know the whole truth about Kilmeny. Do not torment me." "I am going to tell you the story, master, though it will be like opening an old wound. No living person knows it but Thomas and me. When you hear it, you will understand why Kilmeny can't speak, and why it isn't likely that there can ever be anything done for her. She doesn't know the truth, and you must never tell her. It isn't a fit story for her ears, especially when it is about her mother. Promise me that you will never tell her, no matter what may happen."
"I promise. Go on, go on," said the young man feverishly.
Janet Gordon locked her hands together in her lap, like a woman who nerves herself up to some hateful task. She looked very old. The lines on her face seemed doubly deep and harsh. "My sister Margaret was a very proud, high-spirited girl, master. But I would not have you think she was unlovable. No, no. That would be doing a great injustice to her memory. She had her faults, as we all have, but she was bright and merry and warm-hearted. We all loved her. She was the light and life of this house. Yes, master, before the trouble that came on her, Margaret was a winsome lass, singing like a lark from morning till night. Maybe we spoiled her a little. Maybe we gave her too much of her own way. Well, master, you have heard the story of her marriage to Ronald Fraser and what came after, so I need not go into that. I know, or used to know, Elizabeth Williamson well, and I know that whatever she told you would be the truth and nothing more or less than the truth. Our father was a very proud man. Oh, master, if Margaret was too proud, she got it from no stranger, and her misfortune cut him to the heart. He never spoke a word to us here for more than 3 days after he heard of it. He sat in the corner there with bowed head and would not touch bite or sup. He had not been very willing for her to marry Ronald Fraser, and when she came home in disgrace, she had not set foot over the threshold before he broke out railing at her. Oh, I can see her there at the door this very minute, master, pale and trembling, clinging to Thomas's arm, her great eyes changing from sorrow and shame to wrath. It was just at sunset, and a red ray came in at the window and fell right across her breast like a stain of blood. Father called her a hard name, master. Oh, he was too hard. Even though he was my father, I must say he was too hard on her, broken-hearted as she was, and guilty of nothing more, after all, than a little wilfulness in the matter of her marriage. And father was sorry for it. Oh, master, the word wasn't out of his mouth before he was sorry for it. But the mischief was done. Oh, I'll never forget Margaret's face, master. It haunts me yet in the black of the night. It was full of anger and rebellion and defiance, but she never answered him back. She clenched her hands and went up to her old room without saying a word, all those mad feelings surging in her soul and being held back from speech by her sheer stubborn will. And, master, never a word did Margaret say from that day until after Kilmeny was born. Not one word, master. Nothing we could do for her softened her. And we were kind to her, master, and gentle with her, and never reproached her by so much as a look. But she would not speak to anyone. She just sat in her room most of the time and stared at the wall with such awful eyes. Father implored her to speak and forgive him, but she never gave any sign that she heard him. I haven't come to the worst yet, master. Father sickened and took to his bed. Margaret would not go in and see him. Then one night Thomas and I were watching by him. It was about 11 o'clock. All at once he said, "Janet, go up and tell the lass," he always called Margaret that, it was a kind of pet name he had for her, "that I'm Dian, and ask her to come down and speak to me afore I'm gone." Master, I went. Margaret was sitting in her room, all alone in the cold and dark, staring at the wall. I told her what our father had said. She never let on she heard me. I pleaded and wept, master. I did what I had never done to any human creature. I kneeled to her and begged her, as she hoped for mercy herself, to come down and see our dying father. Master, she wouldn't. She never moved or looked at me. I had to get up and go downstairs and tell that old man she would not come. Janet Gordon lifted her hands and struck them together in her agony of remembrance. When I told father, he only said, oh, so gently, "Poor lass, I was too hard on her. She isn't to blame. But I canna go to meet her mother till our little lass has forgiven me for the name I called her. Thomas, help me up. Since she willna come to me, I must e'en go to her." There was no crossing him, we saw that. He got up from his deathbed, and Thomas helped him out into the hall and up the stair. I walked behind with the candle. Oh, master, I'll never forget it. The awful shadows and the storm wind wailing outside and father's gasping breath. But we got him to Margaret's room, and he stood before her, trembling, with his white hairs falling about his sunken face, and he prayed Margaret to forgive him and speak just one word to him before he went to meet her mother. "Master?" Janet's voice rose almost to a shriek. "She would not. She would not. And yet she wanted to speak. Afterwards she confessed to me that she wanted to speak. But her stubbornness wouldn't let her. It was like some evil power that had gripped hold of her and wouldn't let go. Father might as well have pleaded with a graven image. Oh, it was hard and dreadful. She saw her father die, and she never spoke the word he prayed for to him. That was her sin, Master, and for that sin the curse fell on her unborn child. When Father understood that she would not speak, he closed his eyes and was like to have fallen if Thomas had not caught him. 'Oh, lass, you're a hard woman,' was all he said, and they were his last words. Thomas and I carried him back to his room, but the breath was gone from him before we ever got him there. Well, Master, Kilmeny was born a month afterwards, and when Margaret felt her baby at her breast, the evil thing that had held her soul in its bondage lost its power. She spoke and wept and was herself again. Oh, how she wept! She implored us to forgive her, and we did freely and fully. But the one against whom she had sinned most grievously was gone, and no word of forgiveness could come to her from the grave. My poor sister never knew peace of conscience again, Master. But she was gentle and kind and humble until she began to fear that Kilmeny was never going to speak. We thought then that she would go out of her mind. Indeed, Master, she was never quite right again. But that is the story. And it's a thankful woman I am that the telling of it is done. Kilmeny can't speak because her mother wouldn't." Eric had listened with a grey horror on his face to the gruesome tale. The black tragedy of it appalled him, the tragedy of that merciless law, the most cruel and mysterious thing in God's universe, which ordains that the sin of the guilty shall be visited on the innocent. Fight against it as he would, the miserable conviction stole into his heart that Kilmeny's case was indeed beyond the reach of any human skill. "It is a dreadful tale," he said moodily, getting up and walking restlessly to and fro in the dim, spruce-shadowed old kitchen where they were. "And if it is true that her mother's wilful silence caused Kilmeny's dumbness, I fear, as you say, that we cannot help her. But you may be mistaken. It may have been nothing more than a strange coincidence. Possibly something may be done for her. At all events, we must try. I have a friend in Queensley who is a physician. His name is David Baker, and he is a very skillful specialist in regard to the throat and voice. I shall have him come here and see Kilmeny." "Have your way," assented Janet in the hopeless tone which she might have used in giving him permission to attempt any impossible thing. "It will be necessary to tell Dr. Baker why Kilmeny cannot speak, or why you think she cannot." Janet's face twitched. "Must that be, Master? Oh, it's a bitter tale to tell a stranger. Don't be afraid. I shall tell him nothing that is not strictly necessary to his proper understanding of the case. It will be quite enough to say that Kilmeny may be dumb because for several months before her birth her mother's mind was in a very morbid condition, and she preserved a stubborn and unbroken silence because of a certain bitter personal resentment." "Well, do as you think best, Master." Janet plainly had no faith in the possibility of anything being done for Kilmeny. But a rosy glow of hope flashed over Kilmeny's face when Eric told her what he meant to do. "Oh, do you think he can make me speak?" she wrote eagerly. "I don't know, Kilmeny. I hope that he can. And I know he will do all that mortal skill can do. If he can remove your defect, will you promise to marry me, dearest?" She nodded. The grave little motion had the solemnity of a sacred promise. "Yes," she wrote. "When I can speak like other women, I will marry you." End of chapter 15.
Chapter 16 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Katie Gibney, Arkansas, March 2008. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 16. David Baker's Opinion. The next week David Baker came to Lindsay. He arrived in the afternoon when Eric was in school. When the latter came home, he found that David had, in the space of an hour, captured Mrs. Williamson's heart, wormed himself into the good graces of Timothy, and become hell-fellow well-met with old Robert. But he looked curiously at Eric when the two young men found themselves alone in the upstairs room. "Now, Eric, I want to know what all this is about. What scrape have you got into? You write me a letter, entreating me in the name of friendship to come to you at once. Accordingly, I come post-haste. You seem to be in excellent health yourself. Explain why you have inveigled me hither." "I want you to do me a service which only you can do, David," said Eric quietly. "I didn't care to go into the details by letter. I have met in Lindsay a young girl whom I have learned to love. I have asked her to marry me, but although she cares for me, she refuses to do so because she is dumb. I wish you to examine her and find out the cause of her defect, and if it can be cured. She can hear perfectly, and all her other faculties are entirely normal. In order that you may better understand the case, I must tell you the main facts of her history." Then Eric proceeded to do so. David Baker listened with grave attention, his eyes fastened on his friend's face. He did not betray the surprise and dismay he felt at learning that Eric had fallen in love with a dumb girl of doubtful antecedents, and the strange case enlisted his professional interest. When he had heard the whole story, he thrust his hands into his pockets and strode up and down the room several times in silence. Finally he halted before Eric. "So you have done what I foreboded all along you would do, left your common sense behind you when you went courting." "If I did," said Eric quietly, "I took with me something better and nobler than common sense." David shrugged his shoulders. "You'll have hard work to convince me of that, Eric." "No, it will not be difficult at all. I have one argument that will convince you speedily, and that is Kilmeny Gordon herself. But we will not discuss the matter of my wisdom or lack of it just now. What I want to know is this: what do you think of the case as I have stated it to you?" David frowned thoughtfully. "I hardly know what to think. It is very curious and unusual, but it is not totally unprecedented. There have been cases on record where prenatal influences have produced a like result. I cannot just now remember whether any were ever cured. Well, I'll see if anything can be done for this girl. I cannot express any further opinion until I have examined her." The next morning Eric took David up to the Gordon homestead. As they approached the old orchard, a strain of music came floating through the resinous morning arcades of the spruce wood, a wild, sorrowful, appealing cry, full of indescribable pathos, yet marvelously sweet. "What is that?" exclaimed David, starting. "That is Kilmeny playing on her violin," answered Eric. "She has great talent in that respect, and improvises wonderful melodies." When they reached the orchard, Kilmeny rose from the old bench to meet them, her lovely luminous eyes distended, her face flushed with the excitement of mingled hope and fear. "O ye gods!" muttered David helplessly. He could not hide his amazement, and Eric smiled to see it. The latter had not failed to perceive that his friend had until now considered him as little better than a lunatic. "Kilmeny, this is my friend, Dr. Baker," he said. Kilmeny held out her hand with a smile. Her beauty, as she stood there in the fresh morning sunshine, beside a clump of her sister lilies, was something to take away a man's breath. David, who was by no means lacking in confidence, and generally had a ready tongue where women were concerned, found himself as mute and awkward as a schoolboy as he bowed over her hand. But Kilmeny was charmingly at ease. There was not a trace of embarrassment in her manner, though there was a pretty shyness. Eric smiled as he recalled his first meeting with her. He suddenly realized how far Kilmeny had come since then, and how much she had developed. With a little gesture of invitation, Kilmeny led the way through the orchard to the wild cherry lane, and the two men followed. "Eric, she is simply unutterable," said David in an undertone. "Last night, to tell you the truth, I had a rather poor opinion of your sanity, but now I am consumed with a fierce envy. She is the loveliest creature I ever saw." Eric introduced David to the Gordons and then hurried away to his school. On his way down the Gordon lane he met Neil and was half startled by the glare of hatred in the Italian boy's eyes. Pity succeeded the momentary alarm. Neil's face had grown thin and haggard. His eyes were sunken and feverishly bright. He looked years older than on the day when Eric had first seen him in the brook hollow. Prompted by sudden compassionate impulse, Eric stopped and held out his hand. "Neil, can't we be friends?" he said. "I am sorry if I have been the cause of inflicting pain on you." "Friends? Never!" said Neil passionately. "You have taken Kilmeny from me. I shall hate you always, and I'll be even with you yet." He strode fiercely up the lane, and Eric, with a shrug of his shoulders, went on his way, dismissing the meeting from his mind. The day seemed interminably long to him. David had not returned when he went home to dinner, but when he went to his room in the evening, he found his friend there, staring out of the window. "Well," he said impatiently, as David wheeled around, but still kept silence. "What have you to say to me? Don't keep me in suspense any longer, David. I have endured all I can. Today has seemed like 1,000 years. Have you discovered what is the matter with Kilmeny?" "There is nothing the matter with her," answered David slowly, flinging himself into a chair by the window. "What do you mean?" "Just exactly what I say. Her vocal organs are all perfect. As far as they are concerned, there is absolutely no reason why she should not speak." "Then why can't she speak? Do you think? "I think that I cannot express my conclusion in any better words than Janet Gordon used when she said that Kilmeny cannot speak because her mother wouldn't. That is all there is to it. The trouble is psychological, not physical. Medical skill is helpless before it. There are greater men than I in my profession, but it is my honest belief, Eric, that if you were to consult them, they would tell you just what I have told you, neither more nor less." "Then there is no hope," said Eric in a tone of despair. "You can do nothing for her?" David took from the back of his chair a crochet antimacassar with a lion rampant in the center and spread it over his knee. "I can do nothing for her," he said, scowling at that work of art. "I do not believe any living man can do anything for her. But I do not say, exactly, that there is no hope. Come, David, I am in no mood for guessing riddles. Speak plainly, man, and don't torment me." David frowned dubiously and poked his finger through the hole, which represented the eye of the king of beasts. "I don't know that I can make it plain to you. It isn't very plain to myself. And it is only a vague theory of mine, of course. I cannot substantiate it by any fact. In short, Eric, I think it is possible that Kilmeny may speak sometime, if she ever wants it badly enough." "Wants to? Why, man, she wants to as badly as it is possible for anyone to want anything. She loves me with all her heart, and she won't marry me because she can't speak. Don't you suppose that a girl under such circumstances would want to speak as much as anyone could?" "Yes, but I do not mean that sort of wanting, no matter how strong the wish may be. What I do mean is a sudden, vehement, passionate inrush of desire, physical, psychical, mental, all in one, mighty enough to rend asunder the invisible fetters that hold her speech in bondage. If any occasion should arise to evoke such a desire, I believe that Kilmeny would speak, and having once spoken, would thenceforth be normal in that respect. Aye, if she spoke but the one word." "All this sounds like great nonsense to me," said Eric restlessly. "I suppose you have an idea what you are talking about, but I haven't. And in any case, it practically means that there is no hope for her or me. Even if your theory is correct, it is not likely such an occasion as you speak of will ever arise, and Kilmeny will never marry me." "Don't give up so easily, old fellow. There have been cases on record where women have changed their minds." "Not women like Kilmeny," said Eric miserably. "I tell you, she has all her mother's unfaltering will and tenacity of purpose, although she is free from any taint of pride or selfishness. I thank you for your sympathy and interest, David. You have done all you could, but heavens, what it would have meant to me if you could have helped her." With a groan, Eric flung himself on a chair and buried his face in his hands. It was a moment which held for him all the bitterness of death. He had thought that he was prepared for disappointment. He had not known how strong his hope had really been until that hope was utterly taken from him. David, with a sigh, returned the crochet antimacassar carefully to its place on the chair back. "Eric, last night, to be honest, I thought that, if I found I could not help this girl, it would be the best thing that could happen, as far as you were concerned. But since I have seen her, well, I would give my right hand if I could do anything for her. She is the wife for you, if we could make her speak. Yes, and by the memory of your mother." David brought his fist down on the window sill with a force that shook the casement. "She is the wife for you, speech or no speech, if we could only convince her of it." "She cannot be convinced of that. No, David, I have lost her. Did you tell her what you have told me?" "I told her I could not help her. I did not say anything to her of my theory. That would have done no good." "How did she take it?" "Very bravely and quietly. like a winsome lady. But the look in her eyes, Eric, I felt as if I had murdered something. She bade me goodbye with a pitiful smile and went upstairs. I did not see her again, although I stayed to dinner as her uncle's request. Those old Gordons are a queer pair. I like them, though. They are strong and staunch, good friends, bitter enemies. They were sorry that I could not help Kilmeny, but I saw plainly that old Thomas Gordon thought that I had been meddling with predestination in attempting it. Eric smiled mechanically. I must go up and see Kilmeny. You'll excuse me, won't you, David? My books are there. Help yourself. But when Eric reached the Gordon house, he saw only old Janet, who told him that Kilmeny was in her room and refused to see him. She thought you would come up, and she left this with me to give you, master. Janet handed him a little note. It was very brief and blotted with tears. Do not come any more, Eric, it ran. I must not see you, because it would only make it harder for us both. You must go away and forget me. You will be thankful for this some day. I shall always love and pray for you. Kilmeny. I must see her, said Eric desperately. Aunt Janet, be my friend. Tell her she must see me for a little while at least. Janet shook her head but went upstairs. She soon returned. She says she cannot come down. You know she means it, master, and it is of no use to coax her. And I must say, I think she is right. Since she will not marry you, it is better for her not to see you. Eric was compelled to go home with no better comfort than this. In the morning, as it was Sunday, he drove David Baker to the station. He had not slept, and he looked so miserable and reckless that David felt anxious about him. David would have stayed in Lindsay for a few days, but a certain critical case in Queensley demanded his speedy return. He shook hands with Eric on the station platform. "Eric, give up that school and come home at once. You can do no good in Lindsay now, and you'll only eat your heart out here." "I must see Kilmeny once more before I leave," was all Eric's answer. That afternoon he went again to the Gordon homestead, but the result was the same. Kilmeny refused to see him, and Thomas Gordon said gravely, "Master, you know I like you, and I am sorry Kilmeny thinks as she does, though maybe she is right. I would be glad to see you often for your own sake, and I'll miss you much. But as things are, I tell you plainly, you'd better not come here any more. It will do no good, and the sooner you and she get over thinking about each other, the better for you both. Go now, lad, and God bless you." "Do you know what it is you are asking of me?" said Eric hoarsely. "I know I am asking a hard thing for your own good, master. It is not as if Kilmeny would ever change her mind. We have had some experience with a woman's will ere this. Tush, Janet, woman, don't be weeping. You women are foolish creatures. Do you think tears can wash such things away? No, they cannot blot out sin or the consequences of sin. It's awful how one sin can spread out and broaden, till it eats into innocent lives, sometimes long after the sinner has gone to his own accounting. Master, if you take my advice, you'll give up the Lindsay school and go back to your own world as soon as may be." End of chapter 16.
Chapter 17 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Karen Savage. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 17. A Broken Fetter. Eric went home with a white, haggard face. He had never thought it was possible for a man to suffer as he suffered then. What was he to do? It seemed impossible to go on with life. There was no life apart from Kilmeny. Anguish wrung his soul until his strength went from him, and youth and hope turned to gall and bitterness in his heart. He never afterwards could tell how he lived through the following Sunday, or how he taught school as usual on Monday. He found out how much a man may suffer and yet go on living and working. His body seemed to him an automaton that moved and spoke mechanically, while his tortured spirit, pent up within, endured pain that left its impress on him forever. Out of that fiery furnace of agony, Eric Marshall was to go forth a man who had put boyhood behind him forever, and looked out on life with eyes that saw into it and beyond. On Tuesday afternoon there was a funeral in the district, and according to custom the school was closed. Eric went again to the old orchard. He had no expectation of seeing Kilmeny there, for he thought she would avoid the spot, lest she might meet him.
but he could not keep away from it, although the thought of it was an added torment, and he vibrated between a wild wish that he might never see it again, and a sick wonder how he could possibly go away and leave it, that strange old orchard where he had met and wooed his sweetheart, watching her develop and blossom under his eyes like some rare flower, until in the space of 3 short months she had passed from exquisite childhood into still more exquisite womanhood. As he crossed the pasture field before the spruce wood, he came upon Neil Gordon, building a longer fence. Neil did not look up as Eric passed, but sullenly went on driving poles. Before this, Eric had pitied Neil. Now he was conscious of feeling sympathy with him. Had Neil suffered as he was suffering? Eric had entered into a new fellowship whereof the passport was pain. The orchard was very silent and dreamy in the thick, deep-tinted sunshine of the September afternoon, a sunshine which seemed to possess the power of extracting the very essence of all the odors which summer has stored up in wood and field. There were few flowers now. Most of the lilies which had queened it so bravely along the central path a few days before were withered. The grass had become ragged and sere and unkempt. But in the corners the torches of the goldenrod were kindling, and a few misty purple asters nodded here and there. The orchard kept its own strange attractiveness, as some women with youth long past still preserve an atmosphere of remembered beauty and innate, indestructible charm. Eric walked drearily and carelessly about it, and finally sat down on a half-fallen fence-panel in the shadow of the overhanging spruce boughs. There he gave himself up to a reverie, poignant and bittersweet, in which he lived over again everything that had passed in the orchard since his first meeting there with Kilmeny. So deep was his abstraction that he was conscious of nothing around him. He did not hear stealthy footsteps behind him in the dim spruce wood. He did not even see Kilmeny as she came slowly around the curve of the wild cherry lane. Kilmeny had sought the old orchard for the healing of her heartbreak, if healing were possible for her. She had no fear of encountering Eric there at that time of day, for she did not know that it was the district custom to close the school for a funeral. She would never have gone to it in the evening, but she longed for it continually. It and her memories were all that was left her now. Years seemed to have passed over the girl in those few days. She had drunk of pain and broken bread with sorrow. Her face was pale and strained, with bluish, transparent shadows under her large, wistful eyes, out of which the dream and laughter of girlhood had gone, but into which had come the potent charm of grief and patience. Thomas Gordon had shaken his head bodingly when he looked at her that morning at the breakfast table. "She won't stand it," he thought. "She isn't long for this world. Maybe it is all for the best, poor lass. But I wish that young master had never set foot in the Connors' orchard, or in this house. Margaret, Margaret, it's hard that your child should have to be paying the reckoning of a sin that was sin before her birth." Kilmeny walked through the lane slowly and absently, like a woman in a dream. When she came to the gap in the fence where the lane ran into the orchard, she lifted her wan, drooping face and saw Eric sitting in the shadow of the wood at the other side of the orchard with his bowed head in his hands. She stopped quickly, and the blood rushed wildly over her face. The next moment it ebbed, leaving her white as marble. Horror filled her eyes, blank, deadly horror, as the livid shadow of a cloud might fill 2 blue pools. Behind Eric, Neil Gordon was standing, tense, crouched, murderous. Even at that distance Kilmeny saw the look on his face, saw what he held in his hand, and realized in one agonized flash of comprehension what it meant. All this photographed itself in her brain in an instant. She knew that by the time she could run across the orchard to warn Eric by a touch it would be too late. Yet she must warn him. She must. She must. A mighty surge of desire seemed to rise up within her and overwhelm her like a wave of the sea, a surge that swept everything before it in an irresistible flood. As Neil Gordon swiftly and vindictively, with the face of a demon, lifted the axe he held in his hand, Kilmeny sprang forward through the gap. "Eric! Eric, look behind you! Look behind you!" Eric started up, confused, bewildered, as a voice came shrieking across the orchard. He did not in the least realize that it was Kilmeny who had called to him, but he instinctively obeyed the command. He wheeled around and saw Neil Gordon, who was looking, not at him, but past him at Kilmeny. The Italian boy's face was ashen, and his eyes were filled with terror and incredulity, as if he had been checked in his murderous purpose by some supernatural interposition. The axe lying at his feet where he had dropped it in his unutterable consternation on hearing Kilmeny's cry told the whole tale. but before Eric could utter a word, Neil turned with a cry more like that of an animal than a human being, and fled like a hunted creature into the shadow of the spruce wood. A moment later Kilmeny, her lovely face dewed with tears and sunned over with smiles, flung herself on Eric's breast. "Oh, Eric, I can speak! I can speak! Oh, it is so wonderful! Eric, I love you! I love you!" End of chapter 17.
Chapter 18 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Betsy Bush in Marquette, Michigan, February 2008. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 18. Neil Gordon Solves His Own Problem. "It's a miracle," said Thomas Gordon in an awed tone. It was the first time he had spoken since Eric and Kilmeny had rushed in, hand in hand, like two children intoxicated with joy and wonder, and gasped out their story together to him and Janet. "Oh, no, it is very wonderful, but it is not a miracle," said Eric. "David told me it might happen. I had no hope that it would." "He could explain it all to you if he were here." Thomas Gordon shook his head. "I doubt if he could, Master, he or anyone else. It is near enough to a miracle for me. Let us thank God reverently and humbly that he has seen fit to remove his curse from the innocent. Your doctors may explain it as they like, lad, but I'm thinking they won't get much nearer to it than that. It is awesome, that is what it is. Janet, woman, I feel as if I were in a dream. Can Kilmeny really speak?"
"Indeed I can, uncle," said Kilmeny, with a rapturous glance at Eric. "Oh, I don't know how it came to me. I felt that I must speak, and I did. And it is so easy now. It comes to me as if I could always have done it."
She spoke naturally and easily. The only difficulty which she seemed to experience was in the proper modulation of her voice. Occasionally she pitched it too high, again too low, but it was evident that she would soon acquire perfect control of it. It was a beautiful voice, very clear and soft and musical.
"Oh, I am so glad that the first word I said was your name, dearest," she murmured to Eric.
"What about Neil?" asked Thomas Gordon gravely, rousing himself with an effort from his abstraction of wonder. "What are we to do with him when he returns? In one way, this is a sad business." Eric had almost forgotten about Neil in his overwhelming amazement and joy. The realization of his escape from sudden and violent death had not yet had any opportunity to take possession of his thoughts. "We must forgive him, Mr. Gordon. I know how I should feel towards a man who took Kilmeny from me. It was an evil impulse to which he gave way in his suffering, and think of the good which has resulted from it."
"This is true, Master. But it does not alter the terrible fact that the boy had murder in his heart, that he would have killed you. An overruling providence has saved him from the actual commission of the crime and brought good out of evil. But he is guilty in thought and purpose, and we have cared for him and instructed him as our own. With all his faults, we have loved him. It is a hard thing, and I do not see what we are to do. We cannot act as if nothing had happened. We can never trust him again."
But Neil Gordon solved the problem himself. When Eric returned that night, he found old Robert Williamson in the pantry, regaling himself with a lunch of bread and cheese after a trip to the station. Timothy sat on the dresser in black velvet state, and gravely addressed himself to the disposal of various tidbits that came his way. "Good night, Master. Glad to see you're looking more like yourself.
I told the wife it was only a lover's quarrel, most like. She's been worrying about you, but she didn't like to ask you what was the trouble. She ain't one of them unfortunate folks who can't be happy without their everlasting poking their noses into other people's business. But what kind of a rumpus was kicked up at the Gordon place tonight, master? Eric looked amazed. What could Robert Williamson have heard so soon? "What do you mean?" he asked. "Why, us folks at the station knew there must have been a to-do of some kind when Neil Gordon went off on the harvest excursion the way he did."
"Neil gone on the harvest excursion?" exclaimed Eric.
"Yes, sir. You know this was the night the excursion train left. They cross on the boat tonight, special trip. There was a dozen or so fellows from hereabouts went. We was all standin' around chattin' when Lincoln Frame drove up full speed, and Neil jumped out of his rig. Just bolted into the office, got his ticket and out again, and on to the train without a word to anyone, and as black-lookin' as the old Scratch himself. We was all too surprised to speak till he was gone. Lincoln couldn't give us much information. He said Neil had rushed up to their place about dark, looking as if the constable was after him, and offered to sell that black filly of his to Lincoln for $60 if Lincoln would drive him to the station in time to catch the excursion train. The filly was Neil's own, and Lincoln had been wanting to buy her, but Neil would never hear to it afore. Lincoln jumped at the chance. Neil had brought the filly with him, and Lincoln hitched right up and took him to the station. Neil hadn't no luggage of any kind, and wouldn't open his mouth the whole way up, Lincoln says. We concluded him and old Thomas must have had a row. Do you know anything about it, or was you so wrapped up in sweethearting that you didn't hear or see nothing else? Eric reflected rapidly. He was greatly relieved to find that Neil had gone. He would never return, and this was best for all concerned. Old Robert must be told a part of the truth, at least, since it would soon become known that Kilmeny could speak. "There was some trouble at the Gordon place tonight, Mr. Williamson," he said quietly. "Neil Gordon behaved rather badly and frightened Kilmeny terribly, so terribly that a very surprising thing has happened. She has found herself able to speak, and can speak perfectly." Old Robert laid down the piece of cheese he was conveying to his mouth on the point of a knife, and stared at Eric in blank amazement. "God bless my soul, master, what an extraordinary thing!" he ejaculated. "Are you in earnest, or are you trying to see how much of a fool you can make of the old man?"
"No, Mr. Williamson, I assure you it is no more than the simple truth. Dr. Baker told me that a shock might cure her, and it has. As for Neil, he has gone, no doubt for good, and I think it well that he has." Not caring to discuss the matter further, Eric left the kitchen, but as he mounted the stairs to his room, he heard old Robert muttering, like a man in hopeless bewilderment. "Well, I never heard anything like this in all my born days. Never, never. Timothy, did you ever hear the like? Them Gordons are an unaccountable lot and no mistake. They couldn't act like other people if they tried. I must wake Mother up and tell her about this, or I'll never be able to sleep." End of chapter 18.
Chapter 19 of Kilmeny of the Orchard. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Karen Savage. Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery. Chapter 19. Victor from Vanquished Issues. Now that everything was settled, Eric wished to give up teaching and go back to his own place. True, he had signed papers to teach the school for a year, but he knew that the trustees would let him off if he procured a suitable substitute. He resolved to teach until the fall vacation, which came in October, and then go. Kilmeny had promised that their marriage should take place in the following spring. Eric had pleaded for an earlier date, but Kilmeny was sweetly resolute, and Thomas and Janet agreed with her.
"There are so many things that I must learn yet before I shall be ready to be married," Kilmeny had said, "and I want to get accustomed to seeing people. I feel a little frightened yet whenever I see anyone I don't know, although I don't think I show it. I am going to church with Uncle and Aunt after this, and to the Missionary Society meetings, and Uncle Thomas says that he will send me to a boarding school in town this winter if you think it advisable." Eric vetoed this promptly. The idea of Kilmeny in a boarding school was something that could not be thought about without laughter. "I can't see why she can't learn all she needs to learn after she is married to me just as well as before," he grumbled to her uncle and aunt. "But we want to keep her with us for another winter yet," explained Thomas Gordon patiently. "We are going to miss her terrible when she does go, Master. She has never been away from us for a day. She is all the brightness there is in our lives. It is very kind of you to say that she can come home whenever she likes, but there will be a great difference. She will belong to your world and not to ours. That is for the best, and we wouldn't have it otherwise. But let us keep her as our own for this one winter yet." Eric yielded with the best grace he could muster. After all, he reflected, Lindsay was not so far from Queensley, and there were such things as boats and trains. "Have you told your father about all this yet?" asked Janet anxiously. No, he had not. But he went home and wrote a full account of his summer to old Mr. Marshall that night. Mr. Marshall, Sr., answered the letter in person. A few days later, Eric, coming home from school, found his father sitting in Mrs. Williamson's prim, fleckless parlor. Nothing was said about Eric's letter, however, until after tea. When they found themselves alone, Mr. Marshall said abruptly, "Eric, what about this girl? I hope you haven't gone and made a fool of yourself. It sounds remarkably like it. A girl that has been dumb all her life, a girl with no right to her father's name, a country girl brought up in a place like Lindsay. Your wife will have to fill your mother's place, and your mother was a pearl among women. Do you think this girl is worthy of it? It isn't possible. You've been led away by a pretty face and dairy-maid freshness. I expected some trouble out of this freak of yours coming over here to teach school." "Wait until you see Kilmeny, father," said Eric, smiling. "Humph! That's just exactly what David Baker said. I went straight to him when I got your letter, for I knew that there was some connection between it and that mysterious visit of his over here, concerning which I never could drag a word out of him by hook or crook. And all he said was, 'Wait until you see Kilmeny Gordon, sir.' Well, I will wait till I see her. But I shall look at her with the eyes of 65, mind you, not the eyes of 24. And if she isn't what your wife ought to be, sir, you give her up or paddle your own canoe. I shall not aid or abet you in making a fool of yourself and spoiling your life." Eric bit his lip, but only said quietly, "Come with me, father. We will go to see her now." They went around by way of the main road and the Gordon Lane. Kilmeny was not in when they reached the house. "She is up in the old orchard, master," said Janet. "She loves that place so much she spends all her spare time there. She likes to go there to study." They sat down and talked a while with Thomas and Janet. When they left, Mr. Marshall said, "I like those people. If Thomas Gordon had been a man like Robert Williamson, I shouldn't have waited to see your Kilmeny. But they are all right, rugged and grim, but of good stock and pith, native refinement and strong character. But I must say candidly that I hope your young lady hasn't got her aunt's mouth."
"Kilmeny's mouth is like a love-song made incarnate in sweet flesh," said Eric enthusiastically.
"Huh," said Mr. Marshall. "Well," he added more tolerantly a moment later, "I was a poet, too, for 6 months in my life when I was courting your mother."
Kilmeny was reading on the bench under the lilac trees when they reached the orchard. She stood up and came shyly forward to meet them, guessing who the tall, white-haired old gentleman with Eric must be. As she approached, Eric saw with a thrill of exultation that she had never looked lovelier. She wore a dress of her favorite blue, simply and quaintly made, as all her gowns were, revealing the perfect lines of her lithe, slender figure. Her glossy black hair was wound about her head in a braided coronet, against which a spray of wild asters shone like pale purple stars. Her face was flushed delicately with excitement. She looked like a young princess, crowned with a ruddy splash of sunlight that fell through the old trees. "Father, this is Kilmeny," said Eric proudly. Kilmeny held out her hand with a shyly murmured greeting. Mr. Marshall took it and held it in his, looking so steadily and piercingly into her face that even her frank gaze wavered before the intensity of his keen old eyes. Then he drew her to him and kissed her gravely and gently on her white forehead. "My dear," he said, "I am glad and proud that you have consented to be my son's wife and my very dear and honored daughter." Eric turned abruptly away to hide his emotion, and on his face was a light as of one who sees a great glory widening and deepening down the vista of his future. End of chapter 19. End of Kilmeny of the Orchard by Lucy Maud Montgomery.
Listen up, football fans! You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.